Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring the world of Alevi Kurds, specifically looking at the period before 2010, using some really insightful research that's come across our desks.
Yes, and our aim here is to try and unpack the unique identity of this ethno-religious minority in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
We want to explore the forces that, you know, shaped their history and, importantly, their struggle for recognition.
We'll be looking into their distinct faith, their cultural heritage, and some of those pivotal events that really define their experience during that time.
Mm-hmm. The sources we have paint a picture, don't they? A community right at the intersection of Alevism and Kurdishness.
Facing significant challenges, but also showing remarkable resilience. So let's start trying to unravel this. Before 2010, then, where did Alevi Kurds fit in?
Well, it's a fascinating but definitely challenging meeting point. You have Alevism, a tradition that's kind of on the periphery of Shia Islam, quite distinct.
Right.
And that intersects with Kurdish ethnicity. Specifically, we're talking about people who spoke Kurmankazaki and Kurmanji.
And this combination, this intersection, led to something called double exclusion, is that right?
That's the term used, yes.
Yeah.
Basically, they weren't officially recognized by the Turkish state. Not as a Levi in their faith, and not as Kurdish in their ethnicity.
So doubly invisible, in a way.
Pretty much. And it put them in a very vulnerable position. This non-recognition, it wasn't just an oversight. It seems to have been part of an active state policy, really aimed at forging this homogenized Turkish national identity.
Okay, so it was intentional.
That's what the analysis suggests.
Right.
And as a result, Alevi Kurds found themselves marginalized. Not just by the Turkish Sunni majority, which you might expect, but also, interestingly, sometimes in relation to Turkish Alevis and even Sunni Kurds.
Wow, so marginalized from multiple directions. Their Alevi identity set them apart from Sunni Kurds, and their Kurdish identity set them apart from Turkish Alevi. That sounds like a really complex social and political space to navigate.
It absolutely was. And understanding this period, the run-up to 2010, is so important for getting a handle on their historical path and, well, their contemporary situation, too.
What were some of the key moments or shifts in that pre-2010 period?
Oh, you have major historical junctures. Think about the shift from the Ottoman Empire to the Turkish Republic. That's huge.
Right, a massive change.
And then the Dürimi events of 1937-38. Incredibly traumatic. We'll definitely need to talk more about that.
Yes, that sounds crucial.
Later on, you get the Alevi revival, starting around the 1980s, maybe early 90s.
Yeah.
And alongside that, a growing politicization of both Kurdish and Alevi identities.
This Alevi revival, what did that look like? Was it about becoming more public?
Exactly. It represented a really significant shift. For a long time, many practiced taqiyya, you know, concealing their beliefs due to fear of persecution. Mm. The revival marked a move away from that, towards a more open expression of their identity, and importantly, making concrete demands for their rights.
What drove that shift from concealment to assertion? It seems like a big step.
Well, a major factor, paradoxically perhaps, was the state's persistent effort to render Alevi Kurds invisible. All this pressure, combined with the trauma of events like Dersim, Marash, Sivas.
These were massacres.
Yes, horrific events. But instead of erasing their identity, the sustained pressure and trauma actually fostered a stronger sense of shared victimhood. And from that, a kind of resilience and determination to resist.
So the attempt to deny their existence actually backfired.
Arguably, yes. The official denial, the attempt to erase their experience, it seemed to spur a more conscious, more politicized, and more public articulation of their unique heritage.
That's a powerful dynamic. Tragic, but powerful.
It is. And another consequence of the oppression and, frankly, the limited political space within Turkey before 2010 was a significant Alevi Kurdish diaspora.
Right. Many left the country. Where did they mainly go?
Western Europe became a key destination, especially Germany. It hosts a very large Alevi Kurdish population.
And what role did this diaspora play? Were they cut off or still connected?
Oh, incredibly connected and influential. The diaspora became vital centers for preserving their culture, for redefining identity in a new context, and for promoting their cause internationally.
So, activism from abroad.
Absolutely. These diaspora communities set up organizations, held cultural events, and really influenced the movements back in Turkey. It created this sort of transnational network, a feedback loop of awareness and action.
So this whole pre-2010 period sounds like it was absolutely formative, a time of intense pressure that forged a very resilient and politically aware Alevi Kurdish identity, both inside Turkey and beyond.
That sums it up well, I think.
Yeah.
It really laid the groundwork for everything that came after.
Okay, let's dig into the historical roots a bit more. Where does Alevism itself come from?
Alevism's origins are generally traced back to 13th century Central Anatolia. It's this fascinating blend. You've got mystic Sufi teachings, elements that seem to echo pre-Islamic Turkic shamanism, and definite influences from Shia Islam, particularly via Safavid Iran.
A real synthesis. And how did the Kurdish element get woven into that? Are the origins of Kurdish Alevism clear?
That's where things get debated. The genesis is complex. Early narratives, especially those promoted by the Turkish Republic, tended to downplay the Kurdish aspect.
How so?
They often portrayed Alevi Kurds as, well, essentially assimilated Turks, descendants of pre-Islamic Turks, emphasizing the religious identity over the ethnic one, or suggesting that Kurdish-speaking Alevis were originally Turkoman tribes who just happened to lose their Turkish language and adopt Kurdish in remote areas.
So an attempt to fit them into a purely Turkish national story.
Exactly. It wasn't just an academic discussion. It was deeply political, shaping how Alevi Kurds were perceived and how they understood themselves.
But there were counter-arguments.
Oh, yes. Counter-theories emerged, often from within the community, emphasizing unique ethnic origins. Mm. Some highlight the Kurmanki-Zazaki language as marking a distinct Zaza heritage, separate from both Turks and other Kurdish groups.
Interesting. And what does more recent academic research suggest?
Newer scholarship points to the significance of a Kurdish saint, Abu Wafa Taj al-Erifin, who died way back in 1107. And his Wafa'iyya Sufi order seems to have been influential in eastern Anatolia.
Oh, okay.
What's really interesting is that some major Alevi Kurdish sacred lineages, these family lines called Okaks, like the Ozusan Okak, trace their ancestry directly back to Abu Wafa.
Ah, so that suggests potentially different roots compared to Turkish Alevism, which often centers on Hasi Bektash Valley.
Precisely. It points towards a distinct historical and spiritual lineage for Kurdish Alevism, possibly rooted more firmly in eastern Anatolia, and perhaps predating some of the figures central to Turkish Alevism.
That makes sense. But the upper Euphrates basin with its historical Safavid connections seems key here then.
It's considered a core area for the development of Kurdish Alevism, yes.
Now, moving into the Ottoman period, Alevis were often called Kızılbaş. That term sounds like it might have been loaded.
It definitely was. Kızılbaş, meaning redheads, referred to the distinctive headgear associated with the Safavids. The Sunni Ottomans often used it pejoratively, basically as a label for heretics.
Because of the Ottoman rivalry with Safavid Iran.
Exactly. The Kızılbaş's reverence for Ali and other Shia figures made them suspect in Ottoman eyes, seen as potential allies of the enemy. This led to centuries of persecution, discrimination, and sometimes outright massacres.
Yeah, a very difficult period.
Extremely difficult. And this intense pressure led many Alevi communities, including Alevi Kurds, to retreat into remote, often mountainous regions, like Dersim.
Dersim again, it keeps coming up.
It's central. This isolation allowed them to preserve their faith, often practicing takiyya, that concealment we mentioned. Dersim, in particular, managed to maintain a degree of relative self-rule and became a crucial refuge and center for Kurdish Siyid families, those claiming descent from the Prophet's family.
Okay, so Dersim was a sanctuary of sorts. But then comes the Turkish Republic. You'd think with secularism, things might improve, but the sources mention continued marginalization, even painful suppression.
Yes, it's a complex picture. The Republic's nation-building project prioritized a unified, homogeneous Turkish identity. And while officially secular, this identity often implicitly assumed Sunni Islam as the norm.
So Alevis and Kurds didn't quite fit that mold?
They didn't. And specific secularization reforms, paradoxically, hit Alevis particularly hard. The 1925 law for closing Dervish lodges and shrines, for instance, it closed Alevia centers, weakened the authority of their religious leaders, the peers and deeds, and really disrupted the traditional ways of transmitting their faith and knowledge.
So the law, while perhaps intended to curb religious influence generally, had a disproportionate impact on Alevo structures.
That seems to be the case. Restrictions were put on their holy sites. Later laws even allowed for religious leaders to be exiled. The state policies consistently aimed for a single Turkish Islamic, essentially Sunni identity, which inherently denied the distinctiveness of both Alevism and Kurdishness.
There were even attempts to redefine Alevism itself.
Yes, attempts to frame it as just a Turkish cultural thing or maybe a remnant of old Turkic shamanism. Anything to sort of fold it into the Turkish national narrative and disconnect it from its unique syncretic nature and its Kurdish dimension.
It sounds like they were trying to co-opt Alevism into Turkish nationalism, almost positioning it against Sunni Islam as more authentically Turkic while ignoring the Kurdish reality.
That's a good way to put it. But this reframing didn't actually lead to better legal status or rights for Alevis. It was more about assimilation and control. And while secularization impacted all religious groups, the state established the Dayanet, the Directorate of Religious Affairs, which provided a structure and support mostly for Sunni Islam.
But nothing equivalent for Alevis.
No. The Alevi OKAC system, their hereditary spiritual leadership structure, was effectively dismantled by that 1925 law, with no recognized alternative offered. This created a real vacuum, forcing Alevism further underground and making the transmission of traditions reliant almost entirely on oral means, which are inherently more vulnerable.
Making that later Alevi revival almost an attempt to rebuild from scratch, in a way.
In many ways, yes. Rebuilding from a significantly weakened foundation. The sources often include tables outlining these key historical events, Ottoman conflicts, the Republic's founding, the 1925 law, Dersim, later massacres like Marash and Sivas, the 1982, the revival, and you can see the cumulative impact, the constant pressure points on Alevi Kurds before 2010.
It paints a very clear picture of their historical context. Okay, let's focus now on that ethno-religious identity itself, this intersection of Alevism and Kurdishness. It created something unique, but also put them in that double minority position.
Right. Distinct from the Turkish Sunni majority, obviously, but also often distinct within the broader Alevi community if they were Kurdish, and distinct within the broader Kurdish community if they were Alevi.
And we saw how state non-recognition fueled assimilation pressures. But then, starting in the 90s particularly, you have the politicization of both Alevi and Kurdish identities. How did that affect things?
It massively impacted how Kurdish Alevi identity was, well, reproduced, asserted, and talked about in public. The scholar Martin Van Brunessen made an interesting observation. He noted that in the 1970s, Alevism in Turkey was often linked with left-wing progressive politics generally.
Okay.
But by the 1990s, the emerging Alevi movement itself started to specifically highlight the distinct traditions and experiences of Kurdish Alevis.
Ah, so growing self-awareness within the movement.
Exactly. And you saw younger generations, especially those from Kurdish backgrounds, becoming more assertive in identifying as Kurds. Partly, you could say, as a form of protest against the dominant Turkish state ideology that denied that identity.
Language must be central here, too. Kurmanki, Zazaki, and Kurmanji are the main languages, right?
Yes. And Kurmanki Zazaki, in particular, is seen by some Alevi Kurds as a marker of a unique Zaza cultural or ethnic origin, distinct from other Kurdish groups and from Turks.
But it's not always straightforward. I think the sources mention Turkish sometimes being used in rituals.
That's a complicating factor, yes. Turkish was often prominent as a ritual language in some ceremonies, even among Kurdish Alevis. This complexity has sometimes been seized upon in assimilationist arguments to suggest, well, maybe they're not really Kurdish or are closer to Turkish identity.
I see. And adding to that, the state actively suppressed Kurdish languages for decades, didn't it?
Until the early 1990s, yes. And that suppression severely impacted the ability to pass these languages down through generations, threatening their vitality and cultural continuity.
Let's come back to Dersim. It seems impossible to discuss Alevi Kurdish identity without focusing on Dersim. It's described as the heartland.
It really is. Culturally, historically, spiritually, it holds profound significance. Historically, it had a majority Alevi Kurd population, speaking both Zazaki and Kurmanji, and it managed to keep a degree of autonomy for a long time.
A sanctuary, as you said earlier.
A sanctuary and a vital center for those Kurdish Seyyid lineages. But that autonomy was brutally crushed by the state, culminating in those 1937-38 massacres we mentioned, which just devastated their socio-religious structures.
Yet, despite that devastation, Dersim remained this powerful symbol.
Absolutely. For communities in Turkey and in the diaspora, the sacred places there, the Ciğer or Ziyaret, became even more crucial as focal points for identity and collective memory, especially against the backdrop of that near annihilation.
So the significance is tied up with the trauma.
Deeply. The memory of loss, persecution, and also resistance is inseparable from the sacredness of the land itself. And the state's deliberate act of renaming Dersim to Tunçeli in 1935 was clearly an attempt to erase that identity.
So using the name Dersim itself becomes an act of resistance.
A very conscious act of counter-memory against the official state narrative. The struggle over the name is symbolic of the whole struggle for identity recognition.
And the linguistic diversity there, Zazaki and Kurmanji, while enriching, was also something the state tried to exploit.
Yes, by trying to fragment Kurdish identity, promoting the idea that Zazaki was a separate language, not Kurdish, and that Kurmanji speakers were somehow Kurdified Turks, all to bolster the Turkish origins theory of Alevism.
It created internal complexities, too, presumably.
It did. Within the Alevi Kurdish community itself, language, especially Zazaki, became a basis for some to assert a distinct Zaza identity, separate from both Turks and Kurmanji-speaking Kurds. So this linguistic landscape made the community vulnerable to external divided rule tactics and assimilation efforts, adding another layer of nuance to self-identification beyond a simple Alevi Kurdish binary.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh, Hannah.
Rojbosh. Ah, perfect timing, Hannah. Thank you. How's the chai today? Straw.
Smells good. Let's see. Oh, that's lovely. Just right. Not bitter at all today. Excellent. Thanks, Hannah.
Wonderful. A welcome pause.
Definitely needed that. Okay, feeling refreshed. Where were we? Ah, yes. Dersim and the complexities of language and identity.
Right. So let's turn to the core of the faith itself, what Alevi Kurds traditionally call Rahak or Riaheki, the path of truth. What really stands out is its syncretism, isn't it?
It seems incredibly rich, a blend of what exactly?
You've got threads of pre-Islamic Turkic shamanism, a really profound veneration of nature, deep esoteric Sufi mysticism, and significant elements from Shia Islam, especially the reverence for Ali and the 12 Imams.
That nature veneration sounds particularly strong in the Kurdish Alevi context.
It really is. Mountains, trees, rocks, water sources, they're often seen as imbued with sacred meaning, almost alive. And their practices differ quite markedly from mainstream Sunni Islam. Well, they typically don't perform the five daily prayers, namaz, in the same way, nor do they usually observe the Ramadan, the fast. They have their own distinct fasting periods, like during Muharram or for Kizir.
And the Hajj pilgrimage?
Not considered compulsory, like in Sunni Islam. There's generally a rejection of rigid religious rules and dogmas. The central concept is Haq truth, or the divine reality, and figures like Muhammad and Ali are often seen as manifestations of divine light.
What about core beliefs?
Belief in the immortality of the soul is important, along with beliefs in angels, melekler, jinn, similar, and the power of the evil eye. And while oral tradition is huge, they also have the Bayruk, a collection of teachings, moral principles, and ritual guidelines.
You mentioned the Okek system earlier, the hereditary lineages and the roles like peer, raber, murshid, talip. Can you break that down a bit? That was the traditional structure, right?
It was, yes, certainly up until the major disruptions of the 20th century. Basically, society and religion were organized around these sacred lineages, the Okaks, who claimed descent from revered figures like Ali or other saints, Sayyids. Key Kurdish Alevi Okaks include names like Asusin, Baba Mansur, Kureishan, and the different roles within that. You had a hierarchy. At the top, potentially, a Murshid or Pire Piran, the highest spiritual guide, then the peer, the elder, or master from an Okak family. Each lay family, or talip family, would be bound to a specific peer through an oath called Ikwar. The peer gives guidance and officiates ceremonies like the Shem.
And the Raber.
The Raber, or Raber, acted as a guide, assisting the peer and guiding the talip in religious matters. This role was also typically hereditary, coming from a Sayyid Okak. And the talips were the lay followers, affiliated with their specific peer and raber in a lifelong spiritual bond.
So this peer-talip relationship was fundamental.
Absolutely. It was the cornerstone of social and religious organization, ensuring faith was passed down and the community held together. But, as we've said, this system was hit incredibly hard by events like Dersim and the forced displacements later on, breaking many of those vital connections.
Let's talk about the rituals. The Sim ceremony sounds central.
It is the central communal worship. And significantly, men and women participate together, which is distinct from many other Islamic traditions. It involves prayer, ritual music, the mystical dance known as Sama, and the recitation of religious poetry, Deish Nefez Bayet.
Who leads it?
Usually a para or a deed. And the Seme isn't just worship. It's also a space for spiritual reflection, social discussion, community decision-making, even resolving disputes. It really reinforces social bonds.
An internal justice system, almost.
Historically, yes. The community could impose sanctions, with the most severe being duskunuk, a form of social exclusion or excommunication.
And the Sema dance.
It's visually striking and symbolically rich, representing existence, the cosmos, the soul's mystical journey. It became a really powerful public symbol of Alevi identity during the revival in the 90s.
And the Deish, the poetry.
These religious hymns and mystical poems are the heart of the oral tradition, usually sung accompanied by the balama, the long-necked lute, also called saz or tembur. that transmit beliefs, stories, ethics, and carry immense emotional weight.
We also touched on the veneration of nature and sacred sites, the Gier.
Yes, Gierae in Kerman Kizazeki, or Ziyarted. This is really distinctive. Mountains, trees, rocks, springs, even celestial bodies, they're seen as sacred spots, maybe imbued with a spiritual presence or linked to guardian spirits or ancestors.
And they became even more important after the Okak system was disrupted.
It seems so. Especially in places like Dersim, these sites were crucial for daily religious life, for prayers, making vows, seeking healing. When the traditional leadership structure was weakened by violence and displacement, the Gier provided an alternative focus for practice, helping to maintain cultural identity. Lay followers, the Talibs, often took on more responsibility for their upkeep.
So the faith adapted, decentralized in a way.
Exactly. The state violence didn't extinguish religiosity. It catalyzed a shift towards a more Talib-driven, place-based expression of Rahak. It shows the adaptability of the tradition.
And the Sem ceremony, even beyond the ritual, it seems to embody social and political values too.
Definitely. Things like communal accountability, internal justice, the relatively egalitarian participation of women, these are all part of it. It fostered harmony and provided a degree of autonomous social regulation. The shared experience, especially through music and dance, built strong communal bonds.
And the Semevis, the actual buildings.
The emergence of Semevis, especially in urban areas and the diaspora, became critically important. They provided physical spaces for rituals, cultural preservation, community organizing, and became symbols of the struggle for official recognition as places of worship. Their persistence shows how vital the Semem remained, adapting to new environments.
It's helpful to compare these traits, language, key figures, the role of nature, the Okak system, music, historical traumas, with Turkish Alevis and Sunni Kurds. The distinctions become really clear.
They do. It highlights the unique position of Alevi Kurds.
Okay, let's think about the broader sociocultural fabric before 2010. Given the secrecy and suppression, oral tradition must have been incredibly important.
Absolutely paramount. It was the main way to preserve beliefs, cultural norms, historical stories. When writing things down was difficult or dangerous, or when languages were suppressed, the spoken word carried everything across generations.
Who were the key figures in transmitting this?
You had storytellers, sirkbej, bards or singers known as dengbej, and religious poets. They were the custodians of memory and sacred knowledge, reciting deish, epic tales like Memuzin, historical narratives, moral fables. It all happened orally. Even the Bayruk teachings were often passed down this way. Alevi poetry was crucial for morals, history, legends, and expressing that deep reverence for Ali.
It reminds you of other groups in the region, like the Yazidis, who also rely heavily on oral tradition.
It's a similar pattern, yes. A response to historical pressures.
And music. We touched on its ritual importance, but it was broader than that, right?
Oh, absolutely vital. For religious devotion, yes, but also cultural expression, social bonding, and definitely as a form of resistance. It permeated life.
The balama, or saz, seems iconic.
It is. Often seen as sacred, sometimes called the stringed kornan, used for religious hymns, daish, and folk songs. Turku. And then, as you mentioned, there's that renewed interest in the older Dedizi among younger musicians trying to connect with older ritual forms.
And Turku could be in Turkish, Kurmanji or Zazaki.
Yes, reflecting the linguistic reality. In the diaspora, especially Germany, music became a powerful way to talk about migration, suffering, belonging, complex identities, and resisting assimilation. Turku bars became important social hubs.
And protest songs.
Yes. Used in political marches in both Turkish and Kurdish to mobilize people and voice demands. And don't forget other instruments, the gaval flute, the may reed pipe, the zirin sham, the big dahal or davul drum. They're all part of the Kurdish musical heritage shared by Alevi Kurds.
What about community structure and daily life, particularly before urbanization really took hold?
For a long time, until maybe the mid to late 20th century, life was largely structured along tribal lines. Religious and social life was often guided by these tribally organized holy families, the Okaks. That whole Pir Talib system operated within this framework, linking tribes, Sayyid lineages, and individual families.
And life was mostly rural.
Predominantly, yes. Often in isolated areas like Dersim. This provided some autonomy, but also made them vulnerable. Endogamy marrying within the community was common, partly to maintain boundaries and protect their traditions and knowledge.
But this traditional life was massively disrupted.
Catastrophically. by the violence, the destruction, the forced evacuations, especially those peaking in the 1990s during the intensified conflict between the Turkish state and the PKK. It shattered communities, broke those Pir Talep links, forced people into cities or exile.
And this must have impacted the oral tradition too.
Hugely. While oral tradition was a survival tool, displacement meant losing elders, losing connections, losing opportunities for transmission. This sense of loss actually spurred efforts later by younger people and the diaspora to try and record and preserve what remained.
And music in the diaspora adapted too.
Yes, it became a way to navigate new identities, express political views, build community far from home. You see hybrid forms emerge, sometimes called alabesque, and songs with very direct political messages. Music was and is a really dynamic space for cultural adaptation and identity negotiation.
We have to return to Dersim, specifically the events of 1937-1938. The sources use terms like genocide or massacres. It's clearly a defining trauma.
It is, and understanding what led up to it is important. Dersim, as we've said, had this history of relative autonomy, resisting central control from both the Ottomans and the New Republic.
Which was seen as a threat by Ankara.
Exactly. A threat to the ideal of a unified Turkified nation. The 1935 Tenseli Law was a key step. It restructured the province's governance, renamed it Tenseli, put it under military rule, basically setting the stage for intervention.
What was the official reason given?
The pretext was suppressing rebellion, disarming tribes, and needing to civilize the region. That was the official line.
But what actually happened in 1937-38 was brutal.
Extremely brutal. Large-scale military operations, mass killings of tens of thousands of civilians, women, children, the elderly weren't spared, widespread forced deportations, villages systematically destroyed, livestock killed, lands ruined.
The death toll estimates are staggering.
Tens of thousands. The methods were horrific. Aerial bombing, artillery, ground assaults, credible reports of poison gas use, people being burned alive in caves or barns, and a deliberate targeting of Leve Kurdish religious and tribal leaders like Siyet Riza, who was executed.
Which is why many Alevi Kurds, scholars, and observers call it genocide or genocidal massacres.
Yes, due to the scale, the methods, and the perceived intent to destroy a specific ethno-religious group.
What were the consequences for Alevi Kurdish society leading up to 2010? How did this event continue to shape them?
The consequences were profound and lasting. First, the devastation of their socio-religious structures. Killing or exiling so many OKAK members, the peers, the ravers caused irreparable damage. It broke the Pir Talep system, disrupted knowledge transmission. It was a breaking point, especially for Dersim Alevism.
And the trauma.
Deep collective trauma, passed down through generations via stories, laments, mourning rituals, intensified by fear and silence because the state suppressed any open discussion of it for decades.
There was also forced assimilation?
Yes, forced assimilation and displacement. Survivors were forcibly relocated, particularly women and children sent to Turkish areas in the West, aimed at breaking community ties. Children were sometimes given to Turkish families, deliberately erasing their heritage.
But the memory itself became political.
Absolutely, the politicization of memory. From the 1990s onwards, the memory of Dersim became a central rallying point in the demands for recognition, rights, and justice. Calls for an official apology, acknowledgement of the genocide, restitution.
And resilience.
Yes. Despite the cultural loss, the memory also fueled incredible resilience, a determination to preserve and reinvent their identity, often centered on the land, the sacred sites, the Kurram and Misasaki language, all becoming symbols of survival and resistance.
So Dersim is foundational to their modern identity and politics.
Undeniably. The state's denial prevented healing and fostered deep mistrust. The memory of injustice drove demands for recognition right up to 2010. And that renaming to Tenseli, seen as administrative violence. Using Dersim remains a potent act of counter-memory. The whole struggle over the name encapsulates the fight for identity.
This history logically leads into the broader struggle for recognition and rights before 2010. They faced systemic discrimination.
Yes, systemic discrimination, political oppression, social alienation, forced assimilation, all stemming from that fundamental non-recognition of their dual identity. They were often viewed negatively as heretics or deviants by parts of the Sunni majority and the state.
In concrete terms, what did this discrimination look like?
Denial of full religious freedom was key. Semevis weren't legally recognized as places of worship, so no state funding or protection like mosques received.
Mm-hmm.
Discrimination in the education system, which was heavily Sunni focused, and a lack of state protection against violence, tragically shown in Marash, Akoram, and Sivas.
Sivas in 1993 seems particularly significant.
It was. The massacre of Alevi intellectuals and artists at the Medimac Hotel in Sivas was a horrific event that galvanized the community and highlighted their ongoing vulnerability. And remember that double exclusion, marginalized by the majority, but sometimes also facing challenges within broader Alevi or Kurdish contexts.
But out of this came the Alevi revival. More visibility, more demands.
Right. Starting late 80s, early 90s, the Alevi Yanisha, or awakening, more public cultural activities, more assertive political demands. It was partly a reaction against perceived re-Islamization after the 1980 coup and the constant assimilation pressure.
So they started organizing.
Yes, forming religio-political institutions, cultural associations, developing their own theological discourses, adapting rituals, sometimes incorporating modern ideas like gender equality or environmentalism into their framework, often positioning themselves in favor of secularism against political Islam. And the simultaneous rise of Kurdish political consciousness definitely influenced how Kurdish Alevis asserted their specific identity within all this.
How did community mobilization look on the ground in Turkey?
You saw the establishment of many Alevi associations, Dernekler, and foundations focused on culture and advocacy, like the Pir Sultan Abdal Kultur Derneği, and critically, the construction of Semavis. They became more than just potential worship spaces. They were centers for culture, education, social life, and powerful symbols demanding legal recognition.
What about political involvement?
It varied over time. Back in the 50s, 60s, some support for the Democrat Party, the CHP, the Workers' Party, TP. TP was actually the first to mention Alevi rights. There was even an Alevi-led Unity Party, though it didn't have huge appeal specifically among Alevi Kurds. From the 70s on, strong leanings towards the CHP and various leftist socialist groups. And as mentioned, some level of involvement in the Kurdish political movement, including the PKK for some.
And for younger urban Alevis.
Identity expression became quite diverse. Some focused on cultural Alevism, others more on faith, others channeled their identity through leftist activism. But a common thread was often a strong sense of historical grievance and tension with the state.
The diaspora experience seems crucial again here.
Immensely. Migration to Western Europe, especially Germany, started in the 60s, driven by persecution, violence, lack of opportunity. The diaspora became this vital space for the Alevi revival to flourish and for Alevi Kurdish identity to be articulated internationally.
So they organized abroad too?
Very effectively. The first Alevi associations were actually founded in Europe. They set up organizations to preserve culture. Languages like Kurmanki Zazaki and Kurmanji established community centers, festivals, education programs. They lobbied European governments and human rights bodies.
Were there umbrella groups?
Yes, large federations formed, like FEKA and AABF in Germany and Europe. Music, again, was vital for expressing their history, identity, and sense of community in exile. You also saw Dersim-specific associations forming, focusing on that regional identity and memory.
And this connected back to Turkey.
Absolutely. Transnational activism became key, linking the diaspora efforts with the struggle on the ground in Turkey. The spread of Semavis in Turkish cities and in Europe was part of this self-assertion, and the state's refusal to legally recognize them remained a major sticking point.
Their political alignment, often with secular parties like CHP or leftist groups, seems tied to their opposition to political Sunni Islam.
Largely, yes, given the history of oppression, but it's a complex relationship. While secularism seemed protective, the Turkish state's version of secularism, as we saw, also facilitated assimilation. So they faced this dilemma, seeking protection in secularism while challenging its exclusionary nature.
What were the main demands before 2010?
Consistent demands included legal recognition for Semavis as places of worship and fundamental reform of religious education to include Alevi beliefs and perspectives.
Okay, so as we approach the end of 2009, looking back at that period, what's the summary? What were the key challenges and changes for Alevi Kurds?
Well, the enduring challenges were definitely still there. That lack of official recognition, the systemic discrimination, the heavy weight of historical trauma, Dersim, Marash, Sorum, Sivas, and the constant assimilation pressures.
But transformations, too.
Oh, significant ones. The Alevi revival had made them much more visible and organized. The politicization of Kurdish identity offered another avenue for assertion. They were building associations, Semavis, articulating demands much more clearly.
What were those key demands again?
Legal status for Semavis, reform of religious education, crucially, acknowledgement of past injustices like Dersim, and broader cultural and political rights. Plus, you had major socioeconomic shifts, urbanization due to conflict, displacement, and economic reasons, which were changing traditional structures.
So more visible, more vocal, but the core quest for identity and justice was ongoing.
Exactly. The struggle continued on many fronts: legal challenges domestically and at the European Court of Human Rights, political engagement, civil society work, cultural activities, that vital transnational activism from the diaspora.
What about the state's response? Were there any shifts?
There were the beginnings of the state's Alevi opening initiatives around 2007, a sort of tentative acknowledgement, but largely met with skepticism by the community, seen as too little, perhaps not sincere enough.
Was there tension in how they sought recognition?
Yes, an interesting tension. Engaging with things like UNESCO recognizing the SEMA as cultural heritage offered visibility. But some worried it risked folklorizing their practices, detaching them from deep religious meaning. The core goal for most remained genuine religious recognition and rights.
And generational shifts.
Definitely. You saw younger generations, particularly in cities and the diaspora, articulating identity in new ways. This led to internal debates, too, about the right balance between focusing on faith, culture, or politics, the role of traditional leaders versus new forms of organization, how to navigate being both Alevi and Kurdish in a globalized world.
So the pre-2010 period closes with this ongoing quest, really rooted in resilience against decades, centuries even, of adversity.
That's a very accurate way to put it. A community actively shaping its future while carrying the weight of its past.
As we wrap up this examination of Alevi Kurds before 2010, it's undeniably clear their journey is one of immense complexity, but also marked by an incredible, unwavering spirit. Their unique ethno-religious identity, forged through so many historical challenges, really stands out.
Mm-hmm. And that commitment to their traditions, coupled with resilience, is remarkable. The period leading up to 2010 was absolutely pivotal. You see this growing assertion of who they are, clearer demands for basic rights. The echoes of trauma were still there, of course, but combined with the energy of a community finding its voice again.
It really set the stage for the developments that would follow after 2010, continuing that quest for recognition and justice.
Absolutely. The foundations were laid in those preceding decades.
We hope this exploration today has offered you some valuable insights into this fascinating community and their experiences leading up to 2010. The sources we've drawn on provide a really rich basis for understanding, and we certainly encourage you to explore them further if this has sparked your interest.
There's always more to learn about the Alevi Kurdish experience.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.